Hi everyone, this is Don Fleming, guest hosting tonight for Mark Hurst on Tectonic. Tonight I want to present a naughty or nice list of tech advances in the music world that have helped and often hindered the lives of musicians and songwriters. Now right from the start I want to draw a distinction between the two because in the music biz the songwriters generally make out better than the musicians, for reasons that will be revealed. The first tech on the list are player pianos and the rolls that were used to make them play songs for you. They're not the first example of automatic music reproduction. There were already music boxes. There was even a water-powered organ that played interchangeable cylinders back in the 9th century in Baghdad. But the player piano was invented in 1896 by Edwin S. Vody and quickly became a huge success, with various companies introducing models. The mechanism of the early player piano was all pneumatic. Foot-operated bellows provided a vacuum to operate a pneumatic motor and drive the take-up spool. And air through a hole in the paper roll caused the right hammer to strike the right note. The publishing industry at that time was built on the sale of sheet music, and these player pianos were a menace because people didn't need sheet music or even need to know how to play the piano. The sheet music industry argued in court that the music rolls were a violation of copyright, but initially in 1908, the Supreme Court ruled that the rolls were not copies of the plaintiff's music, but were part of the machine, and in their language, the rolls were not a written or printed record in intelligible notation. The court's ruling on the copyright case noted that in 1902 alone, there were over 70,000 player pianos manufactured and between 1 million and 1.5 million piano rolls produced. The publishers lobbied Congress, and the following year they passed the Monumental Copyright Act of 1909. This made it mandatory that a mechanical fee was paid on every copy manufactured, whether or not it was sold. Now, the long-range effect of this was that it was mechanical fees that were applied to emerging tech that was used to reproduce and sell music on wax cylinders, 78s, LPs, 45s, 8-tracks, CDs. So from this law, made for piano rolls, a huge music publishing industry roared into the 20th century. Also, the Copyright Act of 1906 established that songwriters, or the publisher they assigned their compositions to, could claim the copyright to their song for the life of the author plus 50 years. In 1998, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act extended that to life of the author plus 70 years. Now, of course, there's also a valid argument on limiting these extensions and getting works into the public domain quicker. But for creators of music, this was an important victory, and compared to the loopholes and hurdles thrown at musicians trying to make a living on the sale of their records and not the songwriting side, it's a much more equitable system. So, I'd say piano rolls are mostly on the nice tech list, except for one thing. The nature of mechanical piano rolls was that the tempo for each song was always the same throughout. No push or pull, no slowing down a little for a verse or speeding up during a chorus. It's just like a metronome. Now, that tends to suck the feeling out of music, take away the natural ebbs and flows. Eventually, a player piano was built that could record the impressions of a live piano player, and the playback felt a bit more natural. This problem rears its head again when we get to drum machines. But for now, I'd put player pianos and their music rolls on the nice list. Piano rolls were in continuous mass production from 1896 to 2008. Let's hear Jingle Bells as played by a player piano. And then I'll get right back for number two on the Tectonic Naughty or Nice list. Welcome back to Tectonic. I'm Don Fleming, guest hosting tonight for Mark Hurst. Tonight's theme is tech advances that have impacted the livelihoods of musicians, as well as the multitude of other people who have jobs in the music biz. Number two on the naughty and nice tech list is the phonograph. Now, without getting into the details of the earliest devices, it's safe to say that Thomas Edison and his crew pieced together the first device that would become the phonograph. It was his work on two other cutting-edge tech wonders, the telegraph and the telephone, that led to the development of the phonograph. In 1877, he was working on a machine that could transcribe telegraph signals onto a medium, which could then be played back. I think they tried paper first. Then they tried a sheet of tinfoil wrapped around a hand-cranked metal cylinder, and that found through some bizarre process. Sounds going into a horn with a tube and a diaphragm on it could etch sounds onto the tin foil with a cutting stylus. The same disc could then be played back with a playback stylus, and the sound would come back out of the same horn. It was literally the first machine that could both record and playback sound. Edison wasn't that interested in it. I think he was mostly focused on getting the kinks out of the light bulb, which they were going to go mass market with. Over the next few years, Alexander Graham Bell's Volta Laboratory developed the idea, using wax-coated cardboard tubes as the recording medium. And by 1887, they launched the graphophone by having official reporters at Congress use them. I think this early market they were mostly interested in was for people to make notes, which then became the dictaphone. It was for important bosses to churn out letters for their secretaries instead of dictating them as the secretary furiously scribbled away in shorthand. And in fact, commercial versions of the machines were then produced by the Dictaphone Corporation. Word got back to Edison, and he then quickly resumed work on the phonograph. He came up with a thicker, all-wax cylinder, the surface of which could be repeatedly shaved down for reuse, which was perfect for voice memos. Both the graphophone and Edison's perfected phonograph were available to purchase in 1888. In the first of many format wars to come, the wax-coated cardboard tubes were deserted for Edison's all-wax cylinders, and that became the standard format. Edison founded the Edison Phonograph Company that same year, and if you've never been to the Thomas Edison National Historical Park at 211 Main Street in West Orange, New Jersey, I'd suggest you try to make it over there someday. The top floor in the main building includes the office and recording studio for the Edison Phonograph Company. It's still there. It's just beautifully preserved, fairly untouched, since its heyday as one of the first recording studios and record labels. There's a room over to the left that's filled with horns, the horn collection. Now, even though they were also developing early microphones and speaker tech with the telephone, they settled on these brass-belled horns for recording and playback of the cylinders. So this room is just filled with horns of all different shapes and sizes, and it's really, it's like a studio's microphone collection, except it's horns. They would use really big ones with pianos and strings, smaller ones for small combos or monologues. Anyway, kind of nerding out, but it's amazing to be in that room and just imagine all the sessions that went on there. And the rest of the floor is Edison's collection of the earliest prototypes or commercial versions of his audio inventions. The following year, 1889, pre-recorded wax cylinders were marketed. These were the first professionally made recordings of music and humorous monologues. At first, the market for them were Nickelodeons, the first jukeboxes to be found in, arcades and taverns. These were big machines that were very expensive, and at first that was their market. Wurlitzer was one of the companies that would build Nickelodeons at that time for this use, and fairs and things like that. More affordable phonographs designed for home use were introduced and quickly spread to people across the world. A growing international industry of producing recorded entertainment cylinders for the public kicked into high gear, with the most popular titles selling millions of units. Then Emil Berliner came along with a new idea, a single-sided 7-inch disc that was flat. And he founded the American Gramophone Company in 1894. The following year, they acquired the Columbia Phonograph Company, a regional cylinder distributor who were also producing some of their own releases. Due to some legal drama with that I won't go into, Berliner had to abandon that company, transfer all his patents to his trusted machinist, Eldridge Johnson. And in 1901, Eldridge registered a new record company name, the Victor Talking Machine Company. Flat disc started gaining popularity. They had louder volume than the cylinders. A lot of people used stethoscope-like listening tubes for playback of cylinders because it was louder than the playback horn. The cylinder makers tried to compete with this by increasing the playback speed, which gave a louder playback, but it was a shorter playing time. Needless to say, the new flat format was a big hit. The top labels during this early music biz moment were the Edison Phonograph Company, Victor Talking Machine Company, and Columbia Records. So really just these two inventors, you know, spun off the first big labels that were out there, and the way that artists were treated on those labels. For that first decade, they were the top three names in American sound recording. Edison continued with Cylinder Records, upgrading to the mass-produced gold-molded cylinder in 1902, while Columbia transitioned to the flat disc format between 1901 to 1908. That put them more in direct competition with Victor Talking Machine Company, who were exclusively flat disc. So Edison kept improving his cylinders, but saw which way the wind was blowing with the flat disc sales. So instead of going with the flow, he decided to start a new format war and introduce the Edison Diamond Disc Record, which was meant to be the hi-fi standard. The discs were thicker, they played faster, and it would fit up to 5 minutes of audio because it had 150 grooves per inch. So it was flat, but it could only be played on, of course, the new Edison Diamond Disc Phonograph with its special diamond needle. If you've ever run into these things at like record fairs, you know they're like monsters. They're so thick, it's ridiculous. And if you made the mistake to try to play it like with your 78 needle, it's a disaster. It's like you can't play these things unless you get that machine. They started off strong, but then the sales were lagging due mainly, I think, really, well, it was the format, but also that the luster had just gone off so many of the singers on Edison's releases. I think for the first few years, he didn't even put the singer or the band's name on the cylinder release. It was just a song title, kind of like a piano roll. They would announce them sometimes at the beginning of the disc, but many of the bands had names like, here's the Edison Brass Band. That changed as stars emerged from the releases and the labels realized that crediting and marketing the performers was a good way to create demand and sales. Edison lost interest, and by 1928, he shut down the label. He moved those people over to his new radio division. Now, this all sounds pretty good, I guess. For the first time in human history, our songs, our music can be recorded, preserved, and shared. And then we all get to acquire records with music and artists that mean something to us. But it's also from these early inventions and the men running them and their own lawsuits and drama and escapades that, you know, the music biz of today was born. Edison had his own label, and Emil Berliner started two labels, Victor Talking Machine Company, which was later RCA Victor, and Columbia Records. Here's the biggest problem for musicians on this one. These earliest companies did very little to credit or pay the musicians, and as the music biz evolved, these practices became more and more codified. One of the ways they do this is by claiming both the copyright and phono right to the music. This copyright is for ownership of the audio tracks, and the phono right is for the ownership of the particular release, the artwork coupled with the sequence of those songs, but not the songs themselves. Okay, somehow I knew that from the early days, and always claimed the copyrights to the songs and records I put out with labels, but would let them take the phono right. So the one time I couldn't do this, it was when we signed to Columbia, and I knew that that's the major label deal. Okay, but that's not the worst part. The worst part is what's called recoupment. The label acts like a bank, loaning your band some money to make your record, make a video, marketing, get some tour support. This money goes directly to the studios, the producers, and all the other people. It doesn't go to the band to live on, or usually to get any of. The age-old deal is that most new major label artists usually get 12 points, a vague term that's supposed to mean 12% of retail. So the artist gets 12% and the label gets 88%. All right, so the labels do have to pay mechanicals to the publishing company, but if the artist and the band are the songwriters, they have to negotiate a lower rate and cap it off at 10 songs per album. So if you have 12 songs that you wrote on your album, you're only going to get paid for 10, and those probably at 85% of the current mechanical rate. And the labels are pressing in their own plants that they pay themselves for, and they claim a multitude of deductions, but none of that is the worst part. The really bad part is called recoupment. Let's say your loan from the label is $1 million for your studio, producer, mastering fees, two big budget videos, marketing, tour support. So for the sake of easier math, let's say your cut is 10%, not 12%. And that would mean to repay $1 million debt, the album has to earn $10 million. Okay, right. So if it earns $5 million, you've only recouped $500,000. But the label has actually recovered your loan amount, covered all their cost, and are making money. Millions. $6 million. You get nothing. $7 million. Nothing. You've got to hit $10 million, and then you're just even. Then you start getting your 12% after you recoup. But you usually don't recoup because that's the way the system's built. It's literally debt bondage. And that's not the fun kind of bondage, people. In June 2020, there was a bit of a hubbub when Ron Sweeney, a music biz attorney, called on the majors to zero out unrecouped royalty balance for black artists. The only label that seemed to bite was Sony, who issued a statement that they will no longer apply existing unrecouped balances to artist and participant earnings generated on or after January 1st, 2021 for eligible artists and participants. It's not clear who the eligible people are or even what the language actually means, but on a follow-up, Sony also said it would not zero out unrecouped balances and won't modify contracts. They said they would clear the way for some long-standing artists to receive money. I don't think they could afford to zero out unrecouped balances. That money's just long gone. Look, I know a lot of good people who work at those labels, and I know they didn't invent this system. And they all deserve good salaries and health care and retirement plans and paid vacations and holidays. But the people creating the content don't get any of those things. And the one royalty source they have with the label is designed to keep them in debt while the label makes money. So, this system has just been broken since the beginning. How many days go by before there's another musician with health bills they can't pay? And, you see another FundMe page and tribute show. Is this how it should work? Is this the plan for musicians? And look, I know every creative service industry is full of people working from job to job for their whole careers. I can't speak to the woes of all the people in film and artists in the gaming industry and writers, but for musicians, I think this little thing is the worst possible thing. I also think it's really debt bondage, because it's like you're then under a contract where you have to deliver another album. And you say, like, well, we went platinum on the last one, but we haven't made any money. And some bands then try to get out of those deals, and then they get sued. And I'm posting a link about one of those in the Accu playlist. And if you have your own stories, please feel free to share them on the Accu playlist. I've put a couple of links in the Accu playlist on articles that go into more detail on this terrible business practice. One's a really serious paper on the economic analysis of the practice of recoupment, and it has this conclusion. For the record company, artist royalties are a cost of production, which any profit-maximizing firm will attempt to minimize. However, a contractual arrangement that enables a record company to generate a profit while the artist remains unrecouped is to place greater value on financial capital than on intellectual capital. And that's it right there. I mean, that's the nicest way you could possibly put it. Bonded labor is an employment agreement where the worker starts with a debt, only to find that the repayment of the loan is impossible. And this is what hundreds of musicians have experienced as major label artists. You know, just being told, like, yeah, you didn't recoup, but, you know, we do want that second record. I mean, that's the thing. That's why it's like you're under an agreement. That's why it's called bonded labor. You can't even just walk away. And, you know, other artists do break through and hit the recoupment. And when they get re-signed, there's not a recoupment clause. And great. I mean, that's all good. It's just that a lot of money's been made on these other people as well. A lot. And just did not really trickle down to the 12% that these other people deserved. So overall, as much as I love records, I have to vote naughty on this one. Mainly because the guys who invented it got involved in the business of marketing it, and it was their practices that sort of defined where we are now. And, you know, with other inventions, the person doesn't get involved at all, and as we'll see when we get to number three. So for this segment, I wanted to play what's supposed to be the oldest known Christmas-related sound recording in the world. It was made by Thomas Edison's sales agent in England on December 21st, 1888. So I'm going to play that for you, and then I'll be back with Naughty and Nice number three.
Please receive the united good wishes of myself and my family to you and your family, with the best hope for a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you all. With my regards to all the boys in the laboratory, and tell them I hope they're not going to sleep. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you all.
Welcome back to Tectonic. This is Don Fleming, guest hosting for Mark Hurst. I'm working with your help on a naughty or nice list of people and their inventions that were commercially developed, new tech and devices that impacted the lives of musicians. Now, in this case, I think it also really changed the sound of music. George Beauchamp was a vaudeville performer in the early 1900s, playing violin and Hawaiian lap steel guitar. People were crazy about Hawaiian lap steel music in the US and Europe, and it was one of the highest selling music genres for a couple of decades. The sound of these acoustic lap steel guitars had also started to carry over into Western swing, which was just developing. It was always a challenge for acoustic guitar players and lap steel players to be heard over the natural volume of the drums and the horns and the string sections. And even banjos cut through better than guitars. And especially with jazz developing in the early 1900s, bands were getting louder and guitar players were just getting drowned out. So George got an idea. And yeah, other people were playing around with this idea, but George figured it out. He wanted to make a device that would magnify the sound of his lap steel. And so he started with a phonograph cartridge, which was also called a pickup. And he tried using different magnets and coils, which the coils were made of like thousands of tightly wound turns of copper wire. And he just steampunked this whole thing onto the phono cartridge to see if it would pick up the sound of his steel-stringed instrument. Now, the basic idea is the metal strings on your instrument vibrate near the pickup. The vibrations change the magnetic field, which is being caused by the pickup. And then this copper wire coil picks up the variations in the electromagnetic spectrum made by your strings as you play them. It sends that signal through a cable, and then you need an amplifier and a speaker to be able to hear it. Instrument amps for this new idea didn't really have to be invented. They were just modified from another new technology, radio cabinets with their amps and speakers. George connected with Adolf Rickenbacker, an engineer and machinist who became the prime investor and the brand name for their new company. In 1931, they developed and introduced the Rickenbacker Electro A22, nicknamed the frying pan. It's literally the first electric lap steel guitar and considered the first commercially successful electric guitar. Production of the instrument began in 1932. George had applied for a patent for his horseshoe magnet pickup, but that wasn't granted until 1937. In the meantime, a lot of other guitar makers used George's pickup as the basis for their own patent design. Gibson guitars filed for two pickup patents in 1936 and 1938 and introduced the ES-150. And when Charlie Christian started using it in the Benny Goodman Orchestra, there was no looking back. Every guitarist in a band needed an electric guitar and amplifier. The continued popularity of Hawaiian lap steel music was now fueled with electric lap steels, and Western swing music embraced it so much that the lap steel developed into table models with multiple necks and then larger console-size pedal steel guitars with pedal and knee controls for bending notes and other unique sounds. So when you look at the earliest Rickenbacker and Fender and even Gibson catalogs, it's mostly lap steel guitars and amps made for them. Hawaiian music and Western swing made it strong into the 50s as electric guitars then became the best sellers for these companies, facilitating the new country sound coming out of Bakersfield and rockabilly, early rock, R&B, soul. And, you know, Jimi Hendrix, all thanks to George trying to get his lap steel to sound louder on stage. George passed away from a heart attack while deep sea fishing near L.A. in 1941. So he never really saw the full impact of electric guitars and his pickups, which just got louder and louder, and not because of the pickups, but the guitar amps. From being barely heard, the guitar and bass players were now the loudest instruments on stage, and someone uttered for the first time, "Can you turn your amp down?" PA systems, the public address systems that everyone else had to go through with a microphone, struggled for a while to make the singers and the other musicians loud enough. And, you know, I just love that it's such a basic idea, magnets and copper wire. It really hasn't changed much or been improved on since then. stringed instruments still use basic magnetic pickups. Yeah, for me, I put George on the nice list in his pickup idea. What do you think? Any downside to giving the guitarist a little boost? There's a little lap steel Hawaiian music from the Surfers. Here comes Santa Claus in a red canoe.
Here comes Santa in a red canoe, paddling on a magic sea of blue, with a stocking full of joy for every girl and boy. Here comes Santa in a red canoe, now he's coming, got his eyes on you. Jolly old Santa with a heart so true, and a wicky wicky smile for a happy hula isle. Here comes Santa in a red canoe.
Christmas in Aloha Land on the sunny beach, white as snow, and little children understand
Santa Claus is on the go, 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 go. Here comes Santa in a red canoe, paddling on a magic sea of blue, with a whole molly molly Merry Christmas to you. Here comes Santa,
I say there, old bean.
Here comes Santa in a red canoe.
Welcome back to Tectonic. I'm Don Fleming, guest hosting tonight for Mark Hurst. Tonight's theme is tech advances over the years that have impacted the livelihoods of musicians. Well, here I am on WFMU with a wireless signal of stereo audio being sent out over transmitters, received on radios within the broadcast range. You just have to dial in to the right frequency. This tech marvel starts with someone who was a distinguished portrait painter of his time. Born in Boston in 1791, educated at Yale, he was commissioned for portraits of presidents and other notable people, and made a very successful career of it. He was a founder and first president of the National Academy of Design in New York in 1926. He traveled to Europe during this time, and while returning by ship in 1832, he was putting some final touches on his latest painting, The Gallery of the Louvre, when he met a fellow traveler named Charles Jackson, a physician and scientist from Boston, who showed him some experiments that he was doing with electromagnets. So this painter, Samuel Morse, developed something that Jackson showed him into the telegraph system. You would tap out a message on one end in one building, and connected by a single wire, it could be received on the other end as a set of dots and dashes. Morse called the coding system he used with this Morse code. Yes, of course, there were concurrent other developers and some competing systems, but the early popularity of Morse code led it to be used as the worldwide standard code for telegraphs. Now, by the 1850s, there were large wired telegraph companies in countries around the world, and this was the standard for sending text messages, basically, in code, for the next 50 years. Then in 1895, Marconi and his team developed the first wireless radio system. And in 1901, he hired an engineer named John Ambrose Fleming, no relation that I know of, to design and build the world's first large radio transmitter, which then proved that telegraph messages could be transmitted across the Atlantic. This was a huge tech upgrade for the telegraph industry and business, and for the next 20 years, wireless radio was only used in this way. But still, no voice, no music, just dots and dashes. That's what radio was. These early transmitters sent pulses of radio waves. Continuous waves were needed for audio to travel through radio waves. for audio broadcast to be possible, stronger electronic detection and amplification devices had to be created. John Ambrose Fleming, still working for Marconi, designed the first vacuum tube in 1901. It was at first meant to improve the transatlantic radio reception, which it did, but it also became key to building amplifiers with enough power and volume for the speakers in these, you know, radio cabinets that they wanted to sell to people. People already had these home and business radio transmitters, so when vacuum tubes started being manufactured, the race was on for getting to the air with real voices and music. Frank Conrad, an electrical engineer employed at the Westinghouse Electric Corporation, began broadcasting from his Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania garage with the call letters 8XK. Later, the station was moved to the top of the Westinghouse factory building in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Westinghouse launched the station as KDKA on November 2, 1920, the first commercially licensed radio station in the United States. For this first broadcast, Frank scheduled it on Election Day, 1920. That night, from the nation's first commercial radio station, Frank broadcast the result of the 1920 U.S. presidential election. It was Democrat James Cox against Republican Warren Harding. Frank got election results by telephone, and the handful of people who listened in by radio that night knew the outcome, a Harding landslide, before everyone else read it in the newspaper the next day. Around the world, other stations were popping up. Station PCGG in The Hague, the Netherlands, started broadcasting on November 6, 1919, making it arguably the first commercial broadcasting station. In the UK, broadcast began in 1920 on station 2MT from the Marconi Research Center, and the famous soprano Dame Nellie Melba made a celebrated broadcast in June 1920. She was the first artist of international fame to be on a direct radio broadcast. The BBC received a royal charter in 1926, making it the first national broadcaster in the world. By 1931, most U.S. households had at least one radio. So radio went into a few directions. Live programming with dance bands and singers brought right into people's homes for dinner. Radio plays with sound effects. And of course, more news and more politics. Radio in education began. Colleges across the U.S. began adding radio broadcasting courses and their own stations. Curry College in Milton, Massachusetts introduced one of the first broadcasting majors in 1932 and teamed up with WLOE in Boston to have students broadcast their own programs. WFMU signed on the air in April 1958 when it was part of Uppsala College in East Orange, New Jersey. My dad had a shortwave radio from the early 60s that had a big station guide that came with it, and WFMU 91.1 is in there. It's been around a long time. As far as radio's effect on songwriters and musicians, it's a mixed bag. As a songwriter, there are performance royalty organizations, mainly BMI and ASCAP in the U.S., who collect money from the licenses that radio stations pay. These PROs, as they're called, apply a mysterious formula to the data they get from the stations, take a cut, and then 50% of what's left goes directly to the songwriter and 50% goes to the listed music publisher for that song. So yeah, there's at least a system in place for a modest amount of direct payment to a songwriter. But then there's the artist. Until relatively recently, there was no way for performers on the aptly named master recording to collect any performance royalties through radio, at least in the U.S. The UN did ratify the Rome Convention for the Protection of Performers, Producers of Phonograms, and Broadcasting Organizations in 1961. Among other things, it recognized recording artists and the copyright holders for that recording should be compensated for public performance of those recordings. And in Europe, these collections went into effect in the 60s. The U.S. dragged its feet, and the radio cartels argued that radio airplay was already covered by public performance royalties, and performance royalties are only paid out to the copyright owner of the composition, not the master recording. Radio stations would argue that the airplay is such a huge promotion for the recording artist and their labels, who send the records and beg and pay for airtime, that any further compensation is not required. But finally, in 2001, the Librarian of Congress designated that a nonprofit called Sound Exchange was the sole organization authorized to collect royalties paid by services making transmissions of either ephemeral phono records or digital audio of sound recordings. I think it was somewhat of a reaction to satellite radio, but for the first time in the U.S., money was being collected on behalf of musicians for their recordings being played on the radio. Now, if you're a musician with albums on major or indie labels, if they get played on the radio, you and everyone else playing on those releases should sign up with Sound Exchange. They've been fairly aggressive with satellite radio and webcasters, pushing the Copyright Royalty Board for higher rates, and they've developed really, I think, decent and free tools for helping identify your work on there. And they collect from the similar agencies around the world. I mean, I know they were started by the RIAA, which they split off from after a couple years, and the RIAA is there at the behest of the industry. And, you know, part of this was getting the industry's cut of this, which is that they also now get paid when they do own the copyright to your record. And again, that gets back to that giving away the copyright part. Yeah, I mean, it's, again, better than what was there before, which was nothing. I wanted to play, I was looking for like a nice Christmas show. I mean, what I loved about radio, especially in the early days of radio, was how they put on shows and they had sound effects and there's an orchestra playing, but then there's like monologues and singing and, you know, what turned into TV not too long afterwards. But radio, radio, is it in the hands of a bunch of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel? Well, yeah, kind of. Has it improved relations with the musicians and composers? Yeah, it's better than it was. But I think the for me, what tips it is that this entire history of radio, from Morse code to transmitters and vacuum tubes, all lead to right here, the greatest radio station ever, WFMU. So I'm putting radio in the nice list. Let's listen to a little Jimmy Durante Christmas radio show on WFMU.
From Hollywood, Camel Cigarettes present the Jimmy Durante Show.
A-dink-a-dee, a-dink-a-doo, a-dink-a-dee. Oh, what a tune!
Yes, the Jimmy Durante Show with Alan Young, Roy Bargy and his orchestra, the Crew Chiefs Quartet, Candy Candido, and yours truly, Vern Smith, brought to you by Camel Cigarettes. The makers of Camel Cigarettes wish all their friends a very Merry Christmas. Light up a Camel and let Jimmy Durante and his company make your Christmas Eve a pleasant one. And now, here to start things off with his pal, the talented young comedian, Alan Young, is the Wizard of Schnoz himself, the one and only Jimmy Durante, in person.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, now you feel better, you even look better. Attention, listeners. If you got a new radio for Christmas, don't throw it away. That was me. And now with my pal Alan Young, I'll... Hey, Alan, where are you?
I'm up here in the roof, Jimmy. Santa Claus was supposed to be on our program, but he's stuck in the chimney.
Well, push him through.
All right!
Santa, after falling 14 stories into the fireplace, are you feeling all right?
I'm feeling mighty low.
Jimmy, we saved old Santa Claus. Now I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas.
Same to you, Alan, but I'm kind of glad the excitement is over. I didn't mail my Christmas cards in time, so what happens? At the last minute, I had to seal 500 envelopes and lick 500 stamps.
Jimmy, how did you do it?
Does anybody want to buy a Cocker Spaniel with a dry tongue?
This is Tectonic. I'm Don Fleming, guest hosting tonight for Mark Hurst. I've been talking about tech advances in music over the years and how these inventions and their use have impacted the livelihoods of the musicians and songwriters who create the music that is manufactured, marketed, sold, and licensed. Up next, for naughty or nice designation, drum machines. So, back in the 1920s, Henry Cowell was the leading figure in avant-garde music. His work with prepared pianos and tone clusters inspired John Cage, and really everyone in the avant-garde, for decades. His compositions were more about rhythm and harmonics than melody, and his performances were punk rock level. He would, at times, bang on the piano keys with his forearms. Audiences were often hostile towards him while he was playing, and at one infamous show in Leipzig, Germany, in 1923, there was a riot on stage with pro and anti-Cowell audience members rumbling as Henry continued playing throughout the whole thing. 20 people were arrested. In 1930, Henry commissioned Leon Theremin to build the Rhythmicon, and that was the first electronic rhythm machine. It could produce up to 16 patterns at the same time, and Henry wrote several compositions for it. Although this first introduced the idea to the public, Henry and Leon did not pursue it as something to take to market. And when Henry got tired of using it, that was it for drum machines for the next 30 years. In the late 1950s, early 1960s, multiple ideas for drum machines started hitting the market. Harry Chamberlain sold about 100 units of his Rhythm Mate, which had 14 tape loops. It was the same tech that he used in the Chamberlain, a keyboard he invented, which played tape loops for each key. In 1959, Wurlitzer, the organ company, released the Sideman. It used rotating disc like a music box with a slider for the tempo. Wurlitzer had been in business for 100 years already, beginning with giant theater and fairground organs and Nickelodeons and player pianos. They evolved as the tech evolved, making, by the 60s, electric pianos and organs and jukeboxes. And then for 10 years, the Sideman. Drum machine tech advanced, and by the 60s, most organs had a simple drum machine built right in. Another early user and builder in 1960 was Raymond Scott. He created a drum machine that he called Bandito the Bongo Artist that he used on his Soothing Sounds for Baby albums. In the mid-60s, the drum machine became transistorized, so it was smaller, cheaper, and some notable models made it into the market with the Ace Tone, I think, at the forefront. The sound of the drum machine started making its way into popular music. The first number one with a drum machine was Sly and the Family Stone's Family Affair. It was actually a much used instrument by lounge musicians in the 60s and 70s and can be heard on many private press lounge records. But still at this point, it was more of a novelty, not usually a serious replacement for human drummers. In 1980, things changed dramatically with the introduction of the Lindrum computer. Not since the Chamberlain Rhythm Mate had the real sound of drums been used in a drum machine. The Lindrum was the first machine to use digital samples, and it could also be programmed. A lot of session drummers had to buy the things and learn how to program them to stay relevant, and suddenly everybody wanted this new sound. Roger Lynn lent his prototype to Leon Russell, who actually released the first all Lindrum album, Life and Love, in 1979. His pal George Harrison heard about it and ordered one of the first ones, using it on his Gone Troppo album. But where it really and quickly made an impact was just on the sound of 80s pop. Peter Gabriel, The Human League, Gary Numan, OMD, Devo, Prince, who liked to run his through a flanger, Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, basically everybody started using these things. In 1983, ZZ Top went from being a band with gold records to a multi-platinum band with the release of Eliminator, where they eliminated Frank Beard's drums with a Lindrum and Dusty Hill's bass with a Moog Source keyboard. Now, as you might expect, drummers during this time were not big fans. It was costing them work, and the machines were very expensive, and the programming wasn't that easy to learn. The Roland 808, the TR-808, came out around this time, also programmable, but was initially ignored pretty much because it was using generated sounds and not these real drum samples like the Lindrum. But people came around to it later when they got tired of the Lindrum sound and kind of embraced the sound of drum machines with that, you know, generated sound. And those led to an instrument called the Groove Box, which combines a drum machine, synth, sampler, and music sequencer for creating music. And there's many brands and models, but the Roland Groove Box is the one that got the most attention. So, naughty or nice, drum machines were a threat to drummers for a while, but now, or they're just another tool for them to use, right? And I could complain about some of the terrible music made with drum machines, but I love a lot of drum machine music, especially when it's used up front like a drum machine, you know, Kraftwerk, John Fox, Gary Numan. We used a Dr. Rhythm in my band, The Velvet Monkeys. I mean, it was part of our sound. So I do like the drum machine sound, but my issue is the tempo. It never changes. It's mechanical. It's just a metronome. It's kind of like a player piano. With early rock and roll and R&B, gospel, country, there's just a natural push and pull to the tempo. Choruses might push a beat or two and then pull back for the next verse and then push even more for the ending. You could feel the passion in the playing through these dynamics. Engineers and producers in studios started using drum machines as click tracks for drummers to play along to while recording. I mean, they did this for a practical reason. This was before computers, when tape had to be physically cut to edit. If there was a bad drum fill in the keeper take, take three, then you could grab a better fill from take one or two, because they were all the same tempo. So cutting between the takes is easier for the engineer. But there's two problems with this. First, the drummer's self-conscious the whole time, listening to, concentrating on this click instead of the song. And the click restricts the drummer from speeding up or slowing down, even the tiniest bit. To me, this kills the dynamics and power of a song. Now, with some types of music, a perfect tempo is, I suppose, better. As a producer, the bands I worked with were mostly rock bands, and they sounded great live, and I wanted to capture that natural push and pull. So I always tracked the drummer without a click, without a drum machine playing. And yes, drummers in the studio tend to play faster than usual, and you have to tell them to slow down. Typically, I would try to work with the band for a few days before we went into the studio and look at the drummer's beats per minute throughout the song, and then let them know if they're consistently speeding up or slowing down too much in a certain part. Usually that was enough. We would figure out the tempo that worked best for the song and then start the song that way, and I'd use the little drum machine thing only for the drummer to click off his sticks to start the song, to count off the song, and then turn it off. And most of the time, cutting between takes when necessary was fine. And now with computer cut and paste and time stretching, it's just too easy. But the practice was just so pervasive that most engineers and drummers still now use clicks or a drum machine to set a tempo for the drummer. And with computer editing, it's almost worse. It's like you have a real drummer playing, and then they just take a measure or two and copy and paste it to create every verse or every chorus. Just homogenized drums, homogenized everything. And really, to me, it's just like the sound of a Lindrum computer, but just with different drummer sounds. Too mechanical. So, I'm leaning naughty on this one, which is the way Henry Cowell would probably want it, causing trouble while pushing musical boundaries. Let's listen to Can, Silent Night. Tectonic. This is Don Fleming, guest hosting for Mark Hurst. I'm a true fan of Tectonic and really applaud Mark for what he's done all these years. Please check out the archive and listen in. Mark will be back next week. Mark, thanks a lot. Hope I've raised the level of discussion a bit on certain things. And I'll actually be in tomorrow morning filling in for Clay Pigeon from 6 to 9, so I think I'm just going to go find a couch to sleep on now so that I can be ready to roll 6 o'clock. I'll see you then. Happy holidays, everybody. WFMU, East Orange. WMFU, Mount Hope. In New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. And online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel. And it's complicated.
Greetings and welcome, everybody. Welcome to another, hold on while I update my playlist, another edition of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at 7 p.m. following Mark Hurst. Tonight, following the fabulous, the fantastic fill-in by Don Fleming. Really great show that was. I'm here for another hour. Lots of good music for you tonight, in case you were wondering. And we're going to start. I seem to have, this is all pretty much random, but I seem to have a bunch of recent or very recent music tonight. But I'm going to start with something and a couple of older things. I'm going to start with an older thing. Now, this is going to be a Danish group called The Old Man and the Sea, who were around in the early 70s, I think started around 1968 or so. We're going to hear a track from a self-titled album released in 1972. Nice jazzy stuff with everyone's favorite instrument, one of everyone's favorite instruments, the flute. Nice flute interlude on this track, if I haven't messed up here. So again, The Old Man and the Sea, band from Denmark, 1972. Here we go.
Life will all depend
And music there from the group The Old Man and the Sea, Danish group. Sorry about those kind of showbiz vocals. I'd forgotten about that. A little bit, you know, Vegas, but, you know, some Vegas once in a while is okay. The Old Man and the Sea and a track called Monk Song from a self-titled album released in 1972. I'm now going to play something very special. I'm going to make a big announcement about this. And this is going to be hard to play technologically, but just, you know, pray for me and see if I get it right. What I'm going to play now is something not by, but including Shelley Hirsch. Shelley Hirsch is, will need no introduction to many of you. She's great, one of the greatest, I would say, avant-garde vocalists walking on Earth at this point.